Susan was reading from Luke chapter 15, one of the most famous and familiar stories Jesus ever told. It's been displayed, it's been talked about. Even the famous artist Rembrandt did one of his most famous paintings on the story of the prodigal son. It's kind of the background. I think we have a different picture of it, of the painting, do we? Somewhere. There we go. That's Rembrandt's painting of the story of the prodigal son, one of his most famous paintings of all. And so it is a story that is extremely well known. Whether you're a church person or not, you've probably heard the story or some allusion to the story of what is traditionally called the story of the prodigal son. If you were to dive into the details of Rembrandt's painting, you would see how through the painting he displays the different elements of the story of a son coming home, and one of the shoes of the boy is off and his feet are calloused, and one of the father in Rembrandt's painting has two different hands, one of them kind of the stern hand of the father and the other more of a gentle hand like that of a mother. You can see the older brother leering in the background, but Rembrandt and many others have painted and portrayed the story of the prodigal son. It's a very simple plot. You heard the story told and read in the scriptures. A father has two sons. The younger son demands his share of the father's inheritance. He receives it and immediately leaves for this distant land where he squanders it on sexual pleasure and frivolous living, right? After losing everything, he got moved to Lawrence County. I'm just kidding. I live in Lawrence County. When he found himself in the bottom of life, the pig pen of life, he has this awakening. He repents and decides to return home and beg his father's forgiveness. But upon his return, much to his surprise, he is welcomed with open arms by his father, his loving and forgiving father, who even throws this kind of grandiose party on the rebel's behalf. And this celebration infuriates and alienates the loyal older brother. The one who remained home, the one who did what he was supposed to do. And then the parable ends with this father pleading with the firstborn son to join in the forgiveness, to join the celebration of this younger brother who has returned home. And this very famous parable is often labeled the parable of the prodigal son. But in actuality, the story is about two sons, and the younger son and an older son. Two lost sons who represent two different groups of people, both in Jesus' day and in our day. The two groups, the kind of wayward outsiders, those who rebel and go far from home, and then in the story, kind of the established insiders, those who have it together, those who are moral, those who are the religious insider. And then in this renowned story, Jesus compares and contrasts the two sons to propose that there are two very different ways to be alienated from God, to be separated from God, and two common and very improper ways that people often try to earn acceptance from God. Now, we tend to make the focus of the story almost exclusively about the younger son and the father's loving response. If you have heard the story, you've probably heard it most of the time from that perspective. A son who goes away and comes back, and the father's overwhelming response, his loving response to the son who has returned home. But in reality, the purpose of the story is as much about the older brother as it is the younger brother. It's as much about the father as it is the two lost sons. This story is often labeled, and matter of fact, a little subheading in my Bible says the parable of the prodigal son. But it is really more about a prodigal father. To borrow Tim Keller's title, The Prodigal God. Now, Tim Keller is a pastor in New York City. He started Redeemer Church and reached a lot of young professionals in New York City who are very skeptical of the gospel. And if you've never read Keller or heard Keller, he's an outstanding teacher. And he wrote a book called The Prodigal God. A lot of the content of this series comes from Keller's book, The Prodigal God. So if you're looking, it's a very short book. I think it's 120 or so pages. If you're looking for some more in-depth study of what we're going to be talking about in this series, I encourage you to pick up Tim Keller's book, The Prodigal God, and I'll admit unashamedly that I'm ripping off a lot of his content for this series, kind of from a Devin perspective, okay? And so what Keller labels is the prodigal God, the prodigal father. Because the word prodigal actually means to be recklessly extravagant. To spend until there is nothing left. To spend everything. Some of you are thinking, I could label my spouse the prodigal spouse because at Christmas, they spent until there was nothing left. I checked my bank account. Everything was spent. The prodigal wife has come to strike. Recklessly spending. I'm just kidding. I'm not talking about you, babe. You didn't spend everything. Recklessly extravagant. To spend until there's nothing left. And some might say that the word actually accurately describes the father's response as much as it does the younger son's action. You see, this father welcomes his repentant son with reckless grace, with reckless forgiveness. He refuses to count his son's sins against him. He refuses to demand repayment. He refuses to demand that the son pay it back somehow. He refuses to even acknowledge the kind of squanderous life that this young man had lived. And it was a response that offended, the father's response offended and infuriated the older brother who stayed home, and more than likely offended the audience that Jesus was talking to, as we'll see in the weeks to come. Now, it's very important that we know that there are two different groups that Jesus teaches this parable to. Two different groups listening. We saw it in the first two verses that Susan read for us. Let's revisit those. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him. So that's our first group. Tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. And verse 2, and the Pharisees and scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. So we have these two groups. We have the tax collectors and the sinners who kind of represent the younger brothers. They're engaged in the wild living. They are immoral. They are irreligious. And then we have the Pharisees and the teachers who represent the older brother. They held strictly to the law. They were moral. They were religious. They did the right thing to try and please God. And each group responds differently to Jesus. The sinners, Luke describes, the sinners were drawing near to Jesus. Those two words, drawing near, in the original language are written in a progressive tense, meaning that they are constantly ongoing drawing near to Jesus. Did you know that was kind of the theme of Jesus' ministry and Jesus' teaching? That sinners were constantly being drawn to Jesus, being drawn to the teaching of Jesus. There's this ongoing pattern in his ministry that sinners flocked to hear Jesus. They were drawn to him. Very interesting. The moral and the religious reacted very differently. They were puzzled by Jesus. They were infuriated of the attraction of these sinners to Jesus. As a matter of fact, they said in verse 2, this man receives sinners and eats with them. Now that idea that this man receives and eats with them, it was a very customary token of appreciation in that day for someone to sit down with you and have a meal. It was an acknowledgement. It was showing value to you. So if I were willing to sit down with you, it was saying, like, I'm at some level, accept who you are. I appreciate who you are. I see value in you. And so when they're saying to Jesus, this man sits down and eats with sinners, what they're really saying is, how dare Jesus receive and accept and hang out with these thugs? Like, this is unacceptable behavior. And so the parable of Luke chapter 15, which is actually three stories combined into one, three stories of lost items, a coin, a sheep, and a son. These three stories of lost items that are woven together into this one is actually a response to this second group. It's a response to the Pharisees and the lawkeepers. It's a response to the religious people, the moral, those who followed the rules, those who in their minds had it all together spiritually. Jesus is telling this story directed specifically to them. Now, historically, again, the focus has always been on how the Father forgives and welcomes the wayward son, all the way back to the painting of Rembrandt. When you see the painting of Rembrandt, your eyes are immediately drawn to a father forgiving a son. The emphasis of the painting is on the forgiveness of the son. So that's historically how we've kind of read the story. And we love that picture, don't we? We love a picture of a God who forgives sinners. You know why we love it so much? Because we get it. We identify with it. Like, we are prodigals. We are people who have been far from God and needed his loving response and his unconditional grace and forgiveness. We've been in the position in a lot of different ways as the prodigal son. We identify with it. So our hearts are drawn toward that picture of the God who forgives sinners. And something, I don't know about you, but when I was kind of growing up hearing this story, I would almost picture the audience as they listen to this. And I could almost see the audience of Jesus kind of breaking down in tears and weeping and seeking immediate forgiveness from this loving God. We tend to romanticize the story, right? We like want to turn it into, I don't know, the Notebook or something. Like, we want to make it a, you guys are impressed that I know The Notebook, aren't you? We want to romanticize it. Some of you are disappointed that I know The Notebook. I saw it once. Like, you can keep your man card if you watch it once. If you watch it more than once, you need to just turn your man card in with the second viewing. But we tend to turn it into The Notebook. We tend to turn it into some story about that's going to cause the audience to break out into tears and begin to weep and fall at the feet of Jesus seeking repentance because they are estranged from God. But the target of this story is not just the rebellious. Now, it is the rebellious. There is a welcoming Father that no matter how far you've gone from God, He is right there. And when you turn to Him in repentance, He is right there to love you unconditionally, to receive you into His grace. It is the story of the rebellious son. Don't miss that. The story is about this rebellious son, but it's not just about the rebellious son. It's also about the religious, those who keep the rules, those who are the moral insiders. So don't miss that Jesus is pleading with both groups. He is pleading with the outsiders and the insiders, the unrighteous and the righteous, the immoral and the moral. And He is inviting, interesting enough, both groups to His table. He's inviting those who are gone far from God, and He's inviting those who think they're close to God to His table, which implies that both are equally lost. Both are in need of the gospel. And the original hearers in Jesus' day were not driven to tears. They were infuriated. They were angry. They are offended. You see, Jesus is not trying to warm our hearts with the story of the prodigal son. He's trying to wreck our categories of who's in and who's out. And you know what? I identify with the older. Like, I get it. I get why the older son is upset, don't you? That the younger son went away and he squandered everything, and we'll look at more in depth what that means in the weeks to come, but that this younger son went and blew it. Like, I get why the older son is upset. I get why he's angry. I get why he's going to the father saying, "What are you doing? I've been here. I've been faithful. When you needed someone to get up and milk the cows, I was here. I didn't go off and waste the money. I didn't ruin it with prostitutes. I've been here. I've been faithful. I've been at the dinner table every night." I get why the older son is infuriated. I relate to him. You know why? Because I am him. We are the older brother in so many ways, as we'll see as we go through the series together. And in this story, Jesus challenges what nearly everyone then and now thinks about God, about sin, about salvation. We'll unpack all of that in this series. And he's saying that both the irreligious and the religious are both spiritually lost, that both life paths end in spiritual death. Now, this older and younger kind of life pattern is still very common in our era. Older children, and this is not always across the board true, but older children tend to be more stabilized. They tend to be the rules keepers. They tend to be the ones that you come down on the hardest because they're the first one, right? Like, I'm four into this thing. So Levi's like, whatever he wants to do as long as... I apologize to Kaylee this week, my oldest. I'm like, I'm so sorry how when you were little, I treated you and disciplined you and thought you couldn't make mistakes. I apologize right now. 20 years later, I'm still apologizing, you know, while Levi's swinging from a chandelier. I'm so sorry, Kaylee. But that's why our oldest ones tend to be more stabilized, more disciplined, They seem to be the rules keepers. They want to please their parents. It's often the older one that has the more conventional job and wants to stay close to dad and mom. Now, this is not hard, fast rules, but this is the tendency. How many of you have older kids? That's kind of their personality, right? You ever read the book about the different personalities on older, middle, younger? So that's kind of older sibling, older child syndrome. And then there's the younger child who gets away with everything. Does whatever they want to do. The youngest is the rebellious one, the free spirit. The younger child's the one that moves to New York to become an artist, right? That's the younger child. And these same impulses surface in our culture when it comes to religion. You see, within our everyday life, there are older and younger brothers. The younger brothers who are the non-religious, the anti-religious, who believe that moral issues are subjective, that whatever's right for you is right for you, and it may not be right for me. It's all up for grabs. Whatever preferences you have, they tend to reject individuals or institutions who make moral authority claims over their lives. They are the far country rebels. Don't tell me what to do. What's right for you is right for you, and what's right for me is right for me. Our culture is filled with younger brothers. And this rise of kind of the secular spirit activates the older brothers, doesn't it? It mobilizes them. They tend to organize and try to take back culture through political means or some type, or many practice kind of spiritual isolation. And they tend to have a very negative view of the younger brother, just like the Pharisees and teachers of the law. Who is this man that is constantly sitting down to eat with sinners? That was the Pharisees and teachers of the law, the older brothers that Jesus is talking about in the story. And it tends to be those of us that claim to be followers of Jesus, that we love to get together in our packs and look down our noses at the younger brothers and think, how do we recapture morality somehow? So whose side is Jesus on? Well, he answers that question by telling a story. He is on the side of neither the irreligious nor the religious. He invites both sons to the table. Now, in this particular story, he does single out the religious moralism, and he captures it and calls it, as he often does in the Gospels, kind of this deadly spiritual condition. This is an important thing to remember. And we lose sight of this a lot of times. When Christianity appeared on the scene, it was not considered a religion. Like, you know that, right? It was considered a movement of people who were following this guy named Jesus. So when Christianity shows up, it's not even labeled a religion. It was the polar opposite of a religion. It was a non-religion and anti-religion in many ways. As a matter of fact, if you read first century history, the Romans called Christians atheists. That they didn't believe in any God they believed. You know why they called them that? Well, think about it. The first century church, the early church, they had no temple. They had no sacrificial system. That's all that culture knew. They had no rules and regulations. They had no priests, no rituals. And so kind of this Roman world around them began to label them these weirdos, these atheists. And this parable affirms what many and most in the first century believed, that Christianity was unique. It was different. It was unlike any other religion. As a matter of fact, it really wasn't a religion. It was kind of this third way. Most people today consider Christianity a morality-driven religion. But when you read the Gospels, Jesus most often offended the religious people of his day. It was those estranged from religion and moral rituals that were actually intrigued and attracted to Jesus. Every time in the Gospels, when you read that Jesus meets a religious person and an outcast at the same time, and there's multiple instances of this. So Jesus will be interacting with a group of people who include both religious people and outcasts. There are times when it is a sexual outcast. There's times when it's a racial outcast. There's times when it's a political outcast. In all of these instances in the New Testament, in the Gospels, the outcast is the one who actually connects with Jesus. And it's the religious elder brother types who do not. They despise him. As a matter of fact, they eventually kill him. They eventually seek his death. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 21, verse 31, that tax collectors and prostitutes will enter the kingdom of heaven before the religious. Jesus consistently attracted those considered sinners, and he consistently offended the kind of Bible-believing religious people of his days. I find this fascinating. Those who were attracted to Jesus were those who were the most unlike him. You ever thought about that? Those who were drawn to Jesus the most, who you find in this passage being constantly drawn to Jesus, were those who were the most unlike him. Jesus was holy, and he was unholy people were attracted to him. Jesus was completely righteous, and it was the unrighteous people who were drawn to him. Jesus was completely sinless, and it was the sinful people who sat and ate with him and listened to him teach. Those who were unlike Jesus were the most drawn to Jesus. And here's the key question for us. What changed? What happened? What's happened to the church? You see, the kind of outsiders that Jesus attracted are not drawn to our churches. They're not. Instead, we tend to attract the moral and the conservative and the religious and whatever else labels we want to add to the list. That's the people that most churches, no matter what size, no matter what style of worship, no matter what labels they put, no matter if they call themselves seeker-friendly or not, most churches attract people who have some type of religious background, upbringing, something. The immoral, the broken, the marginalized, and the sinful tend to avoid church. Now, we could bring our strategic partner, Pamela Boulding, who deals, again, everyday life with very common people, and she could testify to this very thing as they do ministry in jails and in the broken places of life. As the broken people very rarely are drawn into the church environment. It's like the church has to go into their environments. What happened? What happened? Here's the only conclusion that we can draw. If we're not having the same effect on the people that Jesus did, we must not be proclaiming and living the same message that Jesus did. You know why our mission statement, our purpose is to continue what Jesus began to do and teach? Because what Jesus taught and what Jesus did reconciled those who were far from God, redeemed the rebels, brought in the sinners, brought transformation to those who needed healing. And if we're not doing that, if we're not having the same effect on the same type of people that Jesus did, we must not be proclaiming and living out the same message that Jesus did. And here's our raw reality. If our churches are not appealing to younger brothers, maybe it is because our churches are filled with older brothers more than we care to admit. Which, by the way, listen closely, has nothing to do with how cool your church is. Has nothing to do with your style of music. Has nothing to do with how many lights you have. Has nothing to do with whether your pastor wears jeans or a suit. Has nothing to do with whether you have a worship band or a choir. Has nothing to do with how cool or uncool your church is. It has everything to do with how much we mirror the Father in the story. A father who welcomes, a father who embraces the sinner, and a father, don't miss this, who also invites the pious older brother to join him at the table. You see, here was our tendency a few decades ago now. The church men look around and say, man, we're only got insiders in. We're not doing anything to connect outsiders. So let's lose suits, let's lose choirs, let's put on jeans, let's get a rock band to lead our worship, and then all the outsiders will come flooding into our doors. And did some of that happen? Yes, some of it happened, but ultimately it backfired on the church in some ways. You see that now kind of playing itself out in the millennial generation. And what we missed is that it's not just about making yourselves appealing to the younger brother, it's also about the church calling the pious older brother to the gospel as well. That is about both. It is about the immoral and the moral. It is about the religious and the irreligious, and calling both of them to the gospel again and again and again, that your self-righteousness will not make you right with God any more than your unrighteousness will make you away from God. And that's what Jesus is teaching in this story. The Father is celebrating the return of the lost, and the question is, will we join him? Will we join this Father who embraces and welcomes both the sinner and also invites the pious to join him at the table as he celebrates the return of the lost? Will we join the Father, or will we stay in the distant field and question, why is he making such a big deal over sinners? You see, if you're like me and you're a prodigal who's been redeemed, my tendency is to become more and more like the older brother as I walk the journey. My tendency is to become more like the older brother that tends to look down his nose at all of those younger brothers who are out there, right, messing it up, living it up. Why would he welcome him back? And our tendency as we kind of get, you know, romanticized into our church is to become and to default toward becoming the older brother, which is why Jesus addresses the older brother in the story, the Pharisees and the scribes in the story, more than he does the tax collectors and the sinners. So here's what I want to do. I want to start this series with this invitation. Regardless of what group you're in, regardless if you are the younger brother who feels very far from God and you're sowing your wild oats and you're very distant from God, or regardless of whether you're the older brother, I want you to know today that the Father invites you to his table. I want to invite you to join in the celebration of a loving, forgiving Father who pursues lost people. Far country lost people. And sitting in the seats of a church every week, lost people. Immoral lost people and moral lost people. Righteous and self-righteous. Sinful and those who think they're not quite as sinful as other people. The Father invites us to the table to understand the gospel. So if you are a younger brother today, a rebel, I invite you. The Father invites you to his table. If you are the older brother today, pious, self-righteous, I'm not as bad as this person, I'm better than this person, I invite you today, come to the Father's table. You're in need of grace and forgiveness and the love of a heavenly Father. 7 years ago today, 7 years ago on this day, I reached my lowest point as a prodigal away from God. Today, of all days, 7 years ago, I reached my pig pen in life. And through a process of healing and redemption and restoration, and a Father who constantly invited me back to the table, I stand here today, 7 years later, speaking from Luke chapter 15. Isn't that crazy? A Father who invites us back to the table. Some of you are in the pig pen of life. God has brought you to this moment in time. You've come to yourself. Come to the Father today. He's inviting you. No matter what you've done, no matter what your reputation is, no matter how sinful you believe you are, no matter, Devin, you'll understand what I've done. I can't be forgiven. I've done this. Here's my secrets. The Father invites you to the table today. Those of you that have been sitting in church seats for year after year after year after year, looking down your nose at all the immoral people and the immoral culture in which we live, God invites you to his table today to understand the gospel that each of us, righteous and unrighteous, are in need of the gospel, the story of Jesus Christ. Beginning next week, we're going to dive deeply into this parable and look at the younger son, look at the older son, look at the audience to whom Jesus was talking, and begin to understand what Jesus has to say about sin, salvation, and the father of the story. So I invite you to be a part of A Tale of Two Sons. But as we do that today, the invitation is open for you.